IBIS Reproductive Health is an international nonprofit organization with a mission to improve women's reproductive autonomy, choices, and health. Sarah currently manages qualitative and quantitative research projects in the United States and Latin America to expand safe abortion and reproductive health care access in legally restrictive contexts. Sarah holds a Master of Public Health in Reproductive and Family Health from Columbia University's Mailman School.
Hi, can you hear me okay? Thanks for joining us today. My name is Sarah, and I work with IBIS. I'm going to talk today about some of our findings from Texas, particularly around women's out-of-pocket expenditures for their mandatory consultation visit. And I'd like to acknowledge my co-authors, Dr. Daniel Grossman and Dr. Joseph Potter. I don't have any disclosures. I also want to acknowledge the researchers that have contributed to this work who are part of the Texas Policy Evaluation Project, which is a collaboration between IBIS Reproductive Health, the University of Texas at Austin, and the University of Alabama. You don't have to be in abortion care or do reproductive health work to know what is going on, at least a little bit around abortion laws in Texas. It was hard to miss Wendy Davis's neon shoes as she stood and filibustered at the special session over the summer. And despite both political and grassroots organizing, laws went into effect over the summer, some of the most restrictive in the country. Now, I'm going to take you back with me to 2011. These laws are built on other laws that have already passed in Texas, and our research is looking at those from 2011. House Bill 15, which has already been mentioned, had two main parts. The first was that women had to come for a mandatory consultation visit at least 24 hours before their procedure, and still do. And the other part is that women had, at that consultation visit, had to have an ultrasound performed by the physician who was going to do the procedure, in which they showed, displayed the image, described the image, and made the heartbeat audible if possible. Now, for women who lived at least 100 miles from the nearest clinic, and this isn't the clinic they chose to go to, but the nearest one to their house, if that was over 100 miles away, they could waive the 24-hour waiting period and in exchange for a 2-hour waiting period between their ultrasound and their procedure. The laws went into effect in September of 2011, and the enforcement of the two-visit requirement started in October of that same year. The ultrasound was challenged in the courts, and after an injunction and then an appeal in the Fifth Circuit, went into effect of January of last year. So with this particular study, we were curious about what types of costs women incurred in order to get to their consultation visit and how much they paid. What do we know? We know that these out-of-pocket expenditures, or also called direct non-medical costs in the literature, are defined as costs that are incurred for the abortion but are not healthcare related. So we're talking about childcare or other care requirements and arrangements, lost wages due to missing work or productivity losses, as they're referred to, staying overnight, and any transportation costs having to get to the clinic. One study in 2005 found that of all costs that women incurred, both clinical and non-clinical, for a medical abortion, 25% were attributed to non-clinical costs. And then a more recent study that was published in 2013 found that in women surveyed all over the country, 70% reported some sort of transportation costs with a mean spent $44. This burden can be both unexpected and burdensome on women, particularly low-income women and those living in rural communities. We also know that financial constraints as well as other factors can cause women to delay access to care. Women presenting in their second trimester were more likely to report worrying about costs and other logistical factors in accessing care. When I talk about logistical factors, we're talking about costs, but we're also talking about being referred to a different clinic first or not knowing where to go to a clinic, as well as difficulty in getting there. So for our survey, we recruited women from 8 clinics in 6 different cities across the state between October and December of last year. So we were in Austin, San Antonio, Houston, Dallas, El Paso, and McAllen along the border. We worked with clinics, both Planned Parenthood and independent providers, all of whom provided at least 1,500 abortions in the year. And in order to survey both first and second trimester patients, we required that all clinics that we worked with provide procedures up to 14 weeks. In order for women to participate, they needed to be at least 18 years or older, speak English or Spanish, and have had that ultrasound at their mandatory appointment. So how did we find out what they spent? We asked questions about how they got to the clinic and if they had a friend or family drive them, how much they paid. If they used public transportation or a taxi, how much they paid. We asked them if they had to miss work, and if so, how much wages they lost in that time. And we asked if they had to arrange any care for elders, children, or other folks that they might be taking care of, and how much they paid for that care, and then did they have to stay overnight. And as a reminder, the transportation is all calculated one way. So we included 318 women in our survey, in our analysis, with an average age of 26 and a range from 18 to 44. 48%, almost half of the women, had some college education. 42% were identified as Hispanic, 26% as white, and 20% as black. And 42% were at or below the 100% of federal poverty guidelines. In terms of their pregnancy history, 40% of the women were presenting with their first pregnancy, and 41% had had a previous abortion. And the vast majority of women that we talked to were in their first trimester of pregnancy, which is consistent with what we find with women seeking care across the country. So before we get to what they spent, I wanted to just share with you how women reported the difficulty or ease in getting to the clinic. 25% of women that we spoke with said it was somewhat or very hard to get to the clinic. This was significant for women who were at or below 100% of the federal poverty guideline, who were twice as likely to report that it was difficult getting to the clinic, as well as for women that had to travel more than 20 miles to get to care, who were three times as likely to report it was difficult to get to the clinic. We used 20 miles because that was the median distance traveled. The average was about 41 miles. So in order to measure total out-of-pocket expenditures, we added for each individual woman the transportation costs, childcare costs, wages lost, and overnight stay. And within our population, we found that 46% reported that reported having some out-of-pocket costs, with a mean spent of $141 and a median of $100, and the range went from $2 to $1,000. As you may expect, women in their second trimesters had significantly higher out-of-pocket costs to get to their consultation visit, with an average increase of about $100. And this was often due to the fact that to seek a second trimester appointment, they often had to travel further to get to a clinic, so perhaps had further had more transportation costs, as well as having to stay overnight due to the multiple days of the second trimester procedure. So if we break down those expenditures individually, wages made up the largest percent among those that reported costs. So it was made up 52% on average of the total costs that women had. 30% of the women that we spoke with reported missing work and losing wages, with an average of $126. Childcare, there were 20% of the women that said they made arrangements and paid for childcare, with an average of $63. In terms of transportation, 14% of the women that we spoke with said they had transportation costs, with an average of $43. And overnight stay, while it was the highest spent, which on an average was $203, was reported by 5% of the women. So I think it's important to mention that our reporting of transportation costs was lower among the population than among the sample than expected. And one of the things that we would do differently going forward, we looked at women that paid to a friend and family and also to public transportation or taxi, but not what they paid for driving their own car in terms of gas. So that would be important to add into analysis going forward. And then a lot of these women presented at the clinic with a support person who may have had to take time off work to join their partner or friend or family, and so to consider their wages lost may be worthwhile to include in the analysis. Because we recruited from abortion clinics, our survey does not include women who did not make it to the clinic for care, so we don't have an idea of those that may have had financial constraints and or other factors and weren't able to make it to the clinic, and our numbers are not representative of all Texas women. But taken together, we can say that two visit requirements are burdensome for some women, especially low-income women and those who have had to travel further or live in rural areas. Women presenting in their second trimester had higher out-of-pocket costs, as well as reported worrying more about cost. And given that we're facing further restrictions both in Texas and in other states, we can't deny the importance of both increasing information and access for women as well as decreasing the financial burden for safe and timely access to care. Yeah, that issue of undue burden has come up a lot recently in Texas and other places. We are planning to publish, and our goal is always to hopes of increasing access. I can't say whether it will be undue burden or not at this point, but we're certainly working with folks in Texas to see how best it can be used for advocacy purposes. Yeah?
Actually, just to follow up on that, it might be useful, particularly in the undue burden concept, talk about what $100 means to the women. I think that that's a real challenge that we have, is really conveying what that burden actually is for individuals.
Absolutely. I think that's a good idea. And we have qualitative interviews to go with these data, so we will be working with that to put a narrative together. Yeah, thank you. Yeah. Yeah. Good question. Yeah, clinics are interested, too, in how many women come back. We find anecdotally that most women come back for their second appointment. But unfortunately, depending on where we collected data, we didn't follow women over time, so we weren't able to collect that data to present to you. But in asking women how they feel about their decision after the ultrasound, we consistently find that they are consistent in their decision-making, and the ultrasound doesn't seem to shift their decision.